It is Monday, March the 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, what's come of Turkey with its worsening relations with Europe in the making? Also ahead, the fight for Mosul, Russia, and the team of the Trump at the White House, global warming, and the music of Lou Rawls. In the news, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has intensified his dispute with European nations, claiming that, in his words, Nazism is alive in the West, after two of his ministers were prevented from campaigning in the Netherlands for an April referendum in Turkey, which would increase Erdogan's powers.
Benim bakanıma. Erdogan
says those who are showing inappropriate behavior in Europe to his ministers will pay the price. He also said the police who tried to break up a demonstration by Turks in Rotterdam over the weekend will also pay a price for their behavior. Mark Rutte is the Dutch prime minister. He spoke with reporters about his government's decision to refuse entry to Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu.
We told them that we are against such a visit because this is a Turkish minister, and we don't think it is right for Turkish ministers to campaign in the Netherlands amongst Dutch people with potentially a Turkish passport, yes, but first of all Dutch people to campaign here in the Netherlands.
VOA's Victor Beatty asks University of Denver scholar Jonathan Edelman whether the relationship between Turkey and Europe is at a new low.
Absolutely. I think what we've got is that the two sides have really come to the end of the line. The Turks now are turning towards the Islamic Republic of Iran, towards Russia and China, and to the authoritarian regime. So, and that's very sad because Turkey was showing real signs of hope 10, 15 years ago in the early years of Erdogan, of becoming middle class, more and more democratic, a real model for what we wanted to see, you know, in the Middle East. But of course, what they've been doing, allowing the terrorists to transit Turkish authority to the territory, you know, for well over a year, and also insisting to the Americans that we're not going to let the Kurds, who have played such a major role in the victories that we have won, according to military American commanders, and instead they should be punished and beaten up and killed. And then, of course, most of all, what Erdogan did to over 120,000 Turks, to kill them, to, you know, beat them up, to throw them out of their jobs, some of the best people there, and to blame it all on a 75-year-old, you know, priest living in Philadelphia. Just not credible. And I think the Europeans now have really gotten to the end of the line on this.
The issue is about this April referendum in Turkey on brand new powers for Mr. Erdogan. Why is it so important for him to rally with ministers in these European countries?
Because he wants to show that he's not just a local figure, that he is a regional and even a world figure of great renown. He's setting himself up a lot like Vladimir Putin, this kind of conservative authoritarian nationalism, where they get rid of any pretenses of democracy, that they only have the great leader, which sounds very much about some of the leaders in Europe in the old days that led to such terrible, you know, terrible thing. So this April referendum is so unfortunate because what it means is that the powers that he already has, which are quite considerable, will become almost that of a dictator. And the result is that Turkey will be turned into a medieval country that in some respects will resemble Iran and become very Islamicized. I've been to Turkey for the State Department a couple of years ago, and you could already see the difference between where Turkey was headed in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, modernizing, westernizing, you know, really making progress, and now it's just all gone.
Was this the trend that sparked that July coup attempt?
Well, there's a lot of argument in the literature about whether there really was a coup or whether this was staged by Erdogan as well. Because, for example, if you look at the coup, the first thing you would do if you were military, and obviously that's where you get people for a coup, would be to go ahead and arrest, if not kill, the leader of the other side. But if you look at it, they didn't do that. They didn't even send 20 people out to a seashore resort where they could have had Erdogan very easily. So many people think, the jury's still out on this, but many people still think that it really wasn't a coup, that it was either staged by Erdogan or he let it go on and went ahead and smashed it to say at the end of the military, which for everything they had problematic, they were pro-Western at the end of the day and in NATO, and that was very important for them, and secular. So now we're seeing a real trauma and tragedy, and I think it's broader than this. There's a real rise in the world of authoritarian regimes, and who could have imagined that 20 years ago at the end of the Soviet Union? Anyone who would have said that back then would have been denounced as somebody who absolutely couldn't read the tea leaves.
What are the implications for NATO?
Serious. NATO's got to get its act together, regardless of what we think, plus or minus, about the new president. The fact is that there's been a massive, decline in the capacity of the American military to fight and to fight effectively, abroad. We're going to have to be able to do it. I think the Germans will be on board with us, and they are the most important country in Europe, and they're not putting up 2% either of their GNP. We're facing rough times out there.
What about Turkey's future in NATO?
The very best, it'll be very passive. Nobody trusts it. I don't know whether the EU wants to go all the way and to kick it out, because I was there, as I said, for State Department 2 years ago. I mean, it has a vital role on the southern flank, but now that he's praising, the Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and going to Tehran, he's sending a powerful message here. One other thing we need to keep in mind, what are the Russians going to do? On one hand, they're conservative nationalist authoritarians. On the other hand, historically, and they've made this point themselves, that historically Russia saw the Persian Empire and the Ottoman Turkish Empire as great obstacles and fought a number of wars with them. So, strangely enough, what that great non-democratic authoritarian Vladimir Putin does is going to be very important. The negotiations are there, because if they also have him and his forces actively on their side, that's going to be one of the most serious situations we've had in the last 20 or 30 years. We're going to have to think about how we're reconfigure the way that we're thinking about how Europe and the world is going.
Jonathan Adelman is a professor at the Joseph Curbel School of International Studies. That's at the University of Denver. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. An official with the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq says the remaining western Mosul neighborhoods held by the Islamic State are now completely surrounded, and IS has lost more than half of the territory the militants once held in Iraq. We asked James Jeffrey, a former U.S. ambassador, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, if the coalition's rapid offense is keeping up pace. He says it's more than that.
The State Department coordinator for the fight against ISIS, Brett McGurk, has said that all of the roads have been cut off. The ISIS forces remaining have been surrounded. There were some reports that up to 60% of the western side of the city have been taken in the course of the day. So it's clear that we have got, despite all of the wringing of hands of people about the battle for West Mosul that we have a huge victory coming that will smash ISIS inside Iraq, and it will be one of the death knells of this organization, at least as a state and army.
Islamic State overran Mosul in the summer of 2014, swept across large swaths of the country's north and west. The Iraqi coalition took eastern Mosul earlier this year from IS. Some organizations have said hundreds of thousands of people are trapped inside of Mosul as the fighting continues. We asked Ambassador Jeffrey how the situation is for the citizens of Mosul.
Trapped is too dramatic a word. The civilians have been taken care of. There haven't been any of the humanitarian disasters that people since September were talking about. This is a very well-prepared operation between the international community, the coalition forces, the Iraqi government in Baghdad, and the Kurdish government in Erbil, and they should all get credit for this. Take a look at this versus Aleppo, and you see all the difference in the world, from the slaughter of civilians there and the total ignoring the plight of civilians, in fact, trying to use that as a weapon versus how the coalition has gone about this in Mosul.
James Jeffrey with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. White House aides have been defending President Trump's unsubstantiated claim that former President Barack Obama ordered a wiretap on telephones Mr. Trump used at his Trump Tower headquarters in New York. While administration officials have offered no evidence supporting the Trump claim, intelligence committees in both the Senate and the House of Representatives are asking for details. Some lawmakers say the claim can be wrapped into the probes by the U.S. Senate intelligence community, which has concluded that Russia meddled in last year's presidential election in an effort to help Mr. Trump win. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman examines two issues with VOA's Jim Stevenson ahead of a hearing on Capitol Hill that could move closer to answering both.
Republicans and Democrats are calling on the White House to basically come clean, essentially saying put up or shut up, not in those words, but saying that if the White House has any evidence whatsoever to back up the charge that was leveled by President Trump, and let me just say that the president did not say this is maybe something I suspect, this is something that should be looked into. The president declared on Twitter that this had happened, that President Obama had ordered this.
And he said that he would be proven correct.
Yes, yes. So essentially now what you have are very powerful Republicans and Democrats on a bipartisan basis calling on the White House saying, look, if there is any evidence here that you have, then for goodness sake, let's share it with the American people. Let's bring this out into the open, that this is not something that should be festering. And so far, the White House is essentially turning a deaf ear to these requests. There's sort of this incredible spectacle on a daily basis at the White House briefings where reporters are saying, is the White House going to produce any evidence? If there is no evidence, should the White House apologize to former President Obama? What does the White House have to say? And Sean Spicer, the spokesman, on a daily basis at these briefings, gets up and says, well, this is something that's under investigation, and it wouldn't be appropriate for us to comment. It's sort of an interesting situation where the president led by making the accusation, and now the administration is saying, well, we just can't comment on it. So we shall see how this plays out.
This amid the whole question of who reached out to the Russian government during the elections. Apparently, we know Michael Flynn did, and he resigned his position.
There is an actual weighty matter here, which is to what extent are government agencies, and here we're talking about the FBI, the Department of Justice, as well as perhaps U.S. intelligence agencies, looking at President Trump's inner circle, who, as it turns out, have had some kind of contact with some elements coming from Russia. There are a lot of questions about that. And so the question naturally rises, given that apparently Michael Flynn's conversations were being recorded, to what extent is Donald Trump's team being monitored? And I think that that's a very legitimate question at this stage of where things stand.
And both of these separate issues essentially involve the same investigative organizations of the government. You're talking about the FBI. You're talking about members of Congress opening up official inquiries into these matters.
A lot of this could be resolved on Monday, March 20th, the House Select Intelligence Committee is going to be holding a hearing, and essentially all the big names that you can think of, past and present, from the Department of Justice, the CIA, the director of the FBI, they're all going to troop up to Capitol Hill and speak in open committee and presumably be asked very sensitive questions. And I guarantee you that a lot of people are going to be watching those hearings very closely. And incidentally, they happen at the same time as on the Senate side, the confirmation hearings get underway for President Trump's Supreme Court pick, Judge Neil Gorsuch.
We'll also be watching all of these hearings. Michael Bowman is on Capitol Hill as our Senate correspondent. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
And many thanks to you, gentlemen. I hope everybody will stay with us. Still ahead, a tribute to Lou Rawls.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOAnews.com.
Visit VOAnews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
International team of scientists with the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the University of St. Thomas say their new study is a major step forward in understanding ocean and climate changes. The results indicate the oceans are much warmer now, and they contain the memory of climate change. International Edition's Lori London speaks with one of the study's authors, John Abraham, of the University of St. Thomas.
This is really an international team of scientists who have studied how fast the Earth is warming. And we've got scientists from the United States and also from the Chinese Academy of Sciences, really a top-tier group of people that got together and were able to accomplish this.
So what exactly did the study find? What did it conclude?
Well, on the one hand, we showed what we already knew. That is, the Earth is warming and humans are the cause, and it's been warming for a long time. But what's interesting about this is we were better able to quantify how fast the Earth is warming. I mean, if you think about it, how would you measure the temperature of an entire planet? It's not like a person, you stick a thermometer in their mouth, but we have to measure the temperature everywhere on the planet. And what we show is the vast majority of global warming ends up in the oceans. And so if you want to really measure how fast the Earth is warming, you've got to measure how fast the oceans are warming. So we have an advanced technique to improve our measurements of the ocean. And what we found is we're actually warming about 12 to 13% faster than we thought. So did we do something that no one knew about? No, I mean, scientists knew global warming was happening, but we have a better measurement, and it turns out to be a little bit worse than we previously thought.
So what do you mean when you say worse?
It means that we're warming faster than we thought, and that means that we've got less time to take meaningful action to reduce our emissions of greenhouse gases.
Is there really anything we can do at this point?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot that we can do. The longer we wait, the less we can do, but we can still take meaningful action that will save money and lives in the future. And what's nice is we can take meaningful action with today's technology. We don't need to wait for aliens and pixie dust or cold fusion to save us. We can do it today. We just need the political will.
So besides the oceans, where else does the heat go if the planet's warming?
Well, as I said earlier, most of it goes into the oceans because it takes a lot of energy to warm water compared to air. But some of the energy is melting ice. Right now, we are at the lowest winter sea ice ever recorded in the Arctic, and we're losing ice on Greenland and in Antarctica. It takes energy to melt that ice, and there's also glaciers on top of mountains that are melting. And then there's also the air and land. I mean, extra heat's going into the air where we live, into the atmosphere, and into land. So you can add all of that up, and that's the total set of places where the heat can go. And as I said before, the majority of it's in the oceans, but you've got to also account for these other places.
That's study author John Abraham of the University of St. Thomas, and he was speaking with my colleague Lori London. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The latest astronomical phenomenon to pique the interest of scientists is called the fast radio burst. Fast radio bursts, or FRBs, are just that. Very fast, lasting less than 5 milliseconds, but brilliant and powerful pulses of electromagnetic energy at radio wavelengths. Now, a new study authored by scientists at Harvard University and the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics suggests that these fast radio bursts just might be the result of advanced alien technology. They theorize these FRBs could be energy leakage from planet-sized transmitters powering interstellar probes in distant galaxies. One of the researchers says an artificial origin of these FRBs is worth considering and examining, since scientists haven't been able to find any possible natural source. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It's time now for a little something from our music department.
You'll never find as long as you live someone who loves you tender like I do.
No doubt that's Lewis Allen Rawls, better known to most of us as Lou Rawls. He began singing at the age of 7 at the Greater Mount Olive Baptist Church on the south side of Chicago. He later sang with local groups where he met other stars in the making like himself. Sam Cooke and Curtis Mayfield remained friends with Lou Rawls throughout their careers. Mayfield died in 1999, Cooke in 1964, and Rawls in 2006. You'll Never Find Another Love Like Mine was one of Rawls' biggest hits, topping charts not only in the U.S. but around the world when it was released in 1974. Frank Sinatra once said that Rawls had the classiest singing and silkiest chops in the singing game. In 1986, Sinatra, who had just turned 71, appeared on Lou Rawls' TV special, Parade of Stars.
I have been a follower, an avid fan of yours since day one, and I have always wanted to sing with you. I have sang songs that you have sang before me. And I want to sing one with you so that I can say I have sang with the chairman of the board.
It's about time you said it, because I was getting lonely up here.
Please. Yeah, buddy. Let's try one. We'll do it.
Of All the Way?
Yeah, that's a good one.
When somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you.
Yeah. How's about she's happy to be near you when you need someone to cheer you? Come what may.
Who knows where the road will lead us? Only a fool would dare say.
Yeah.
You know the next line?
Taller than the tallest tree. That's how deep it goes. If it's real.
It was a big day recently on the south side of Chicago, where Lou Rawls was born in 1933, when they held a huge tribute to Lou Rawls Weekend to celebrate the man and his music. Through the magic of giant TV screens and masterful editing, Lou sang one of his favorite hits, Lady Love, for the tens of thousands who gathered.
Right now, we'd like to dedicate this song to all the lovely ladies in the room this evening. Tell you how we feel about you, girls. Hey. Lady Love,
Your love is soothing like a summer's breeze. My lady love, your love is tender as a baby's touch, and you give me all of the things that I need so much. You're my world, lady love. Love, lady love. Your love is cooling like the winter snow. My lady love. Your love is cozy as a fire.
You know, Frank Sinatra nailed it. Silkiest chops in the singing business. Man, what a great singer Lou Rawls was. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned for the latest world news coming up next. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now a little bit more of Lou Rawls.
To have someone like you, who wants a smooth and easy thing, and all of the good times that it brings. My lady love, you've been with me through all of my ups and my downs, my crazy turnarounds. Lady love, I once was lost, but now with you I'm found. You got the love I need, and I want to stay around. Heaven sent you down, lady love. Yeah, let me tell you that it's not easy to keep love going smooth. You know, people are people, and they all have their moods. It's so nice to have someone like you who wants a smooth thing, and all of the good times and the joy that it brings. My lady love, you've been with me through all of my ups and my downs, my crazy turnarounds. Lady love, I once was lost, but now with you I'm found.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From time to time, the United States identifies certain individuals as crucial to the operation of terrorist organizations. These include persons who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant threat of committing acts of terrorism. When such an individual is identified, the U.S. government places that person's name on the list of specially designated nationals and blocked persons. Their assets within U.S. reach are immediately frozen, and the designated person is locked out of the U.S. financial network. Additionally, U.S. persons are not allowed to conduct business with a designated person. In this way, the United States works to disrupt financial networks for terrorists and terrorist organizations. In a push to disrupt the operations of the terrorist group Al-Nusra Front, the U.S. Department of Treasury designated Iyad Namzi Saleh Khalil and Bassam Ahmad Al-Hazri under Executive Order 13224. This action took place the day after the United Nations added these individuals to the UN Security Council ISIL and Al-Qaeda sanctions list, obligating its member states to freeze their assets, including locking these individuals out of the international financial system, prohibit their travel, and prevent them from acquiring weapons. The Al-Nusra Front, formed 5 years ago as a subsidiary of Al-Qaeda, is a jihadist group fighting in Syria with the goal of setting up an Islamist regime in that country. Since 2016, Iyad Namzi Saleh Khalil has been the Al-Nusra Front's third highest officer. As such, he has participated in senior leadership discussions regarding the Al-Nusra Front's overall strategy. In his prior position as Emir of Daraa, Syria, Khalil presided over the group's security and intelligence operatives. Bassam Ahmad Al-Hazri has long-standing ties with Al-Qaeda. In the past, he has served as a religious advisor of the Al-Nusra Front, and since June 2016 has been the group's Emir of Daraa. From overseeing militant operations to developing al-Nusra Front strategy, these senior al-Nusra Front leaders and al-Qaeda terrorists are responsible for providing key support to the violent terrorist group, said John E. Smith, acting OFAC director. The Treasury Department, in line with actions just taken by the United Nations, is cutting off their access to the international financial system to further disrupt al-Nusra Front's ability to plan and execute terrorist attacks.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.